What it do, listeners? Welcome to part two of our What's Up Wednesday with Jeffrey Thorne, or as my co-pilot dubbed it, part one remixed.
That's right. We spent the first part talking about Jeff's career like it was easy, and it feels easy sometimes because these hardships are every day. But here's the fact of the matter. Jeff is a black male, like I'm a black male, and Wilson is a black male. And it affects how we move through the world.
What's up? What's up?
What up?
What's up?
What's up?
What's up?
It is Wednesday, my dude.
You are now tuned in to What's Up Wednesday from the Power You in Fiction podcast. Jeffrey Thorne Part 2, Life As It Was Lived.
Welcome back, my dude. Was talking a little wild at the end of Part 1, weren't you?
I know. I was just sort of taken by how Johnny Everyman, his story sounds and how it meant for this Jeff if you remove the blackness. When Jeff said to me, "It lives harder than it reads," that really stuck with me because even without all the things being said, me listening to that first part without explicit mention of his blackness, I still hear all the subtext that someone who hasn't lived it doesn't. But we've always known that it's something that we have to consider first.
Right, so how are we tackling this?
We're going to start all the way back at the beginning and focus on the blackness of his Star Trek sci-fi origin. Because way back when we were researching for the pilot season, we had those core questions, and his answer to the first question last time is the same as his answer to my first question this time. But in the context of his existence as a black boy.
You talking about the question that started it all off. When was the first time you saw yourself in a fictional character, and what effect did that have on you?
That's the one. And Jeff's answer is so precise, and in some ways, that made him.
I remember. I can tell you point blank. Part of the reason I'm a writer. My parents broke up. I was at my dad's place. He had his little black and white TV in DC in some little apartment. And one of the things we would do for fun is we would watch Star Trek on that crap TV, Star Trek reruns, the original series. And they did an episode called The Ultimate Computer, written by, I believe, by DC Fontana, who used DC because her name was Dorothy and being a woman in science fiction was really hard back then.
Yeah.
And this dude comes on, who's the guy who designed all the computers on the Enterprise, Dr. Daystrom.
M5 tie-in.
M5.
This is Daystrom.
Daystrom, acknowledged.
M5. Do you know me?
Daystrom, Richard. Originator of Comtronic Duotronic Systems. Born.
Stop.
And I was like, wait, what? I mean, who was there? That was enough. That was part of the reason we were watching it anyway. Right? Look at this. There's George Takei's there. Michelle Nichols there. All these people on the bridge working together. This is great. Plus Spock. Oh, my God. Right. And then homeboy shows up. Yeah, this is Dr. Daystrom. He's smarter than Spock. He designed all this stuff and he's got a better version of it. Now, at the end of it, he ended up going nuts. Right. Because can't have a black man with that much smarts. Got to go crazy.
20 years of groping to prove the things I've done before were not accidents. Seminars and lectures to rows of fools who couldn't begin to understand my systems. Colleagues laughing behind my back at the boy wonder and becoming famous, building on my work.
Jimmy's on the edge of a nervous breakdown, if not insanity,
which might not be that far from the truth. But he was I mean we're gonna swear he was the shit. I was like riveted. I was just like, what the hell? And Spock's talking to him like he's just like another Spock. And he told Captain Kirk to screw off because he's going to do this, and that's what happened? Damn! Right? And after that, I was like, oh, okay, I guess it's open. I guess it's open season, open field. I'm doing what I want. I'm doing this. I'm writing this stuff. I'm going to write this stuff. This is great. I didn't know we could be in it like that. It was damn. Right? And then you start seeing on the Star Trek show, who are every week doing increasingly cool stuff, character most people don't even remember, Dr. Mbenga. I don't know why Bones was out those episodes, but black ass Dr. Mbenga was in there being Dr. Mbenga. And he was cool. people don't ever talk about him, but he was there for multiple episodes. There are a couple of times where they had black actors as challenging people. Captain Kirk's boss was Afro-Spaniard, I believe, right? Another thing you never really saw, Admiral whatever his last name was, but he was clearly both black and Latin. If he wasn't, he so looked it.
Stop recording. Not one man in a million could do what you and I have done. Command a starship. 100 decisions a day, hundreds of lives, staked on you making every one of them right. Now I'm telling you, Captain, either you accept a permanent ground assignment or the whole disciplinary weight of Starfleet Command is going to light right on your neck.
But all of that in Star Trek kind of shaped my entree into science fiction. And I was like, I wasn't one of the kids who wanted to wear the uniform or dress up like that. I was like, people write this, right? I want to do that. And then Ursula Le Guin, my favorite author, wrote a series of young adult novels called, they're called Earthsea. There's, I think, four or five of them now. He just died. Rest in power, sister. But it was the first, the lead character is basically a Native American. His best friend's black, right? Lots of powerful women in this thing. And I didn't know these were even things, right? This is just like, this is just a story being told to me. But it was a story about people of color running around fighting dragons and digging rings out of the ground and rescuing people and doing all this stuff. And she didn't make a big deal. And by the way, they're all different colors. She just told you what they look like. And so this lead dude basically looked like an Apache, right? And his best friend looked like an African. And I was like, I'm down for this. That book changed the rest of my life. So yeah, representation absolutely freaking matters. Absolutely it matters because it generates, stimulates the brain in a way that cannot be oversold. So absolutely that matters. The combination of those two things made me into probably a writer, certainly an artist. And it was because I was in those stories. Didn't mean I didn't like the other stories. I love The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe and all those other things. As you all know, we have to learn how to project ourselves into fiction that doesn't include us.
Right.
Right? We teach ourselves to do that so we can continue to enjoy. We don't consciously go, okay, whatever. It just happens. You just do it. But when you see your own self in there and it's not a stereotype and it's not at the butt of a joke, it's just I'm in there, something changes in your center. Your center shifts. And it's not about racism. It's not about, like, the story itself is not about, see how these white people doing this. Like, I get tired of that story over and over again. I like to see us, like, have a space adventure. Like, I want to see Finn in Star Wars. I feel every 11-year-old who sees Force Awakens sees Finn running around doing stuff. As much as I have certain problems with a little bit of some of it as a storyteller, overall, they're in that world now.
Yeah.
Those kids, it's like they're never going to grow up without a president who is black, and they're never going to grow up with Star Wars that didn't have a central character that was black. Okay. Let's have, and what's her name? Rose Tycho from the new movie. That's a situation where there's no Asian kid now in the world who's going to grow up with a Star Wars that doesn't have an Asian protagonist who kicks ass.
True that.
Okay. Forever. As long as we're here and they have movies, that's the truth. Right. And some people get all bent about that. Like, well, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, look, you guys got 98% of everything. That 2% of non-whites and non-straights doing stuff, we can have that. Let us have that. Just sit down for a minute. It's not hurting you, but it's helping a lot of people.
Yo, man. What an answer. Like, I love when we start these joints off like this. I'm locked in. Locked all the way in.
Yo, that reminds me of those conversations we be having about how we grew up in 90s Nicktoons and we had Kenan and Kel and all that. And then we had Gerald on Hey Arnold and Max, several other black characters. And like the 2000s came and we were like, yo, we know we could be here. Where did we go?
Yeah, it's crazy. And like,
the absence.
Yes, it is. It was noticeable. And we had the characters and they were shown in multifaceted ways. Like you always be saying, Susie Carmichael had the biggest house on the block. That was important.
Right.
So, yeah, the dearth of it after, you know, we'll say that exodus of just great black talent in storytelling was just like crushing, man.
And that's the same type of dearth Jeff had when he saw inclusiveness post Star Trek era. Sounded like in that you consumed a lot of different mediums of story. So when you're consuming radio shows and comics and TV shows and books, and you're looking at how they created something, how does that affect the type of stories you want to tell? And what are some strengths and weaknesses you find in telling stories in a particular medium?
Any medium? Well, let me put my blackness on for a second. One thing that bugged me was Star Trek was the only person putting black people in it. If you look at the other shows, there might be one black dude here and there. Generally not anywhere near the lead. Like, as much as I love Mission Impossible, the black character on that show didn't say anything. He just did stuff. Like, he was great at it, but he wasn't, like, for the most part, doing anything. Like, he didn't have a love interest. He didn't have a personality. He was just like, Barney, how are we going to blow up that bridge with all these people around? Don't worry about it. I got it. And then the whole rest of the episode would just be him wiring stuff and doing something. It was cool for a 10-year-old to see that, but it wasn't like Star Trek where they would show up and they'd be a doctor or they'd be the Commodore. The guy that was in charge of Kirk was black. The Commodore that almost court-martialed Kirk was a black dude. Actually, he was a black Latin dude. How about that? All right. These kind of things make an impression on me and you start to notice their absence because I thought of that as just normal. Star Trek was my first movie, TV show that had science fiction component. So anything that wasn't like that, I was like, well, where are all the black folks? Where are the Asian people? Like, is everybody white? What the hell's going on? Are we not supposed to be here? Are they not expecting us to survive this long? Like, what happened to all the black? Where is everybody? Right? This is as a kid. So I wouldn't say it's a conscious thing, but when Milestone Comics showed up, I was like, oh, I'm not the only one who thinks this. Because up until then, I didn't have that conversation very much. I thought, oh, it's just crazy Jeff thinking his thoughts. But when I saw there was enough people to make an entire company based on the fact of where the hell is everybody else, I was like, oh, I guess this is real. So
his dad did him right. He was on the path early, and just like in part one, he ends up attending high school at the Duke Ellington School of the Arts.
Ooh, the Duke, world-renowned jazz singer, songwriter, and composer. All-around legend from the Harlem Renaissance. If you ain't know, now you know.
Same exact one. See, the blackness is in the details. Duke Ellington was from D.C., a.k.a. Chocolate City, a.k.a. one of the blackest city in the nation, a.k.a. the city where Jeff was from and where you currently reside.
Right. And growing up a black boy in a black city, I'm confident there were powers that be who never imagined Jeff would amount to anything coming from his environment, especially in that time.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about because Jeff has had to overcome people outside his household. His parents were great, who were supposed to help guide him, trying to tell him that his goals were out of reach.
For me, it's a special level of mean for an authority figure to look at a kid, just a little kid or a young adult kind of kid, but like a kid nonetheless, and just dismiss their potential.
It almost broke him. And it hurt a little bit to listen to him recall that, even though we know that the ending isn't so bad.
But I wasn't trying that. I wanted to be a writer. Which made people laugh and who what makes you think? A lot of that. But one of the things is I have had people tell me that my whole life. People in authority have been telling me. I had a guidance counselor in high school. God, I can't remember her name. Thank God I can't remember her name because I would burn her ass down. Even if she's dead, I would burn her down. She brought me in her office one day. She just didn't like me. She took a dislike to me. I don't know. Maybe I was a little bit too snarky as a teenager. I certainly never got in any real trouble, but I was one of those kids who would pop off if you said some stupid shit to me. And she didn't like it. But I never said anything bad enough to get sent to the principal. That was the problem. So I was good at it. She just decided she didn't like me. She brought me in her office in my senior year, and she's like, so you're going to be a janitor. You know that, right? And I was like, excuse me? Like, not that there's anything wrong with being a janitor, but, huh? Aren't you the guidance counselor? Aren't you supposed to be, like, trying to uplift me? She's like, I've seen a lot of black men with your attitude, and you have no future, basically. You're going to be doing this, you're going to be doing that, and you're going to wonder your whole life why white people aren't giving you stuff. That's you. And I was like, I think that's you. That's what I think. Are we done here? And then she was like, this little perfect rocket, you know, like she just never could get me. But when I left that room, it hurt me. It cracked me, man. I was like, it was almost like, it wasn't what she said. It was that she was a grown up and I was a kid. I graduated college at 15, high school at 15. I was a kid. You know, and I was like, this grown ass woman just tried to break me, like on purpose, straight up tried to break me. And it wasn't that she did it. It was that she tried it. That made me feel horrible. Like the fact that a grown up would have it in for me like that. Like, damn, what did I do? Like people have been beat down in the streets and hallways. You know, students have been carried off by the cops. Like, but she hates me enough that she's going to try and wreck my whole life with this moment. Wow. What did I do to this chick? You know, couldn't figure out what it was. So then I started thinking, what was it about me that made her just take that dislike? I couldn't figure that out. Then when I was in college, it happened again twice. My guy, what they call my mentor. I was an actor at this point. You have no future in this business. You should quit now. You're wasting your money. You're wasting your folks' money. You're wasting our time. You have no future in this. What are you doing? And I was like, huh? Aren't you supposed... Again, the same question, right? Like, aren't you supposed to be, like, uplifting and pushing me forward? Like, what are you talking about? It's like, well, you just have an irreverent attitude and you don't, you know. Well, and I was like, look, I told you all this in public. I'm going to tell you like this in private. I am not rich. My folks are not rich. This is one of those schools that if it was Harvard, everybody would understand why we're paying so much damn money for me to be here. This is a little school. At this time, CalArts was a little school in California. A conservatory, which meant if I didn't graduate, none of my credits counted. Right? I had blown my scholarship because I yelled at the dean at one point. They were like, okay, no more scholarship. and then a couple of years later, a different mentor said basically the same thing. I don't know if you have this in you. And I was like, what is up with me? That these grown-ass people keep trying to turn me off my path, right? So this is childhood, young adult, older childhood, young adulthood. Adults, people in authority kept trying to get me to quit. So by the time I got out into the world, I'd already told three people to their face, people in authority over me, go fuck yourself, straight up. Like, I don't know who you think you're talking to, but I'm not one of these soft-ass people that their daddy sent them to the school because they couldn't get in somewhere. I busted my ass to get into the school. I beat other applicants to get into the school because we had to audition to get in here. So if you all made the mistake of bringing me in, I suggest you look in the mirror.
That's a tough listen, man.
Yeah, and it feels tough because it feels real. And all this happened before Jeff got out in the world.
Yo, before he even got that Christmas acting gig... It must have been like really real, like realer than real, because we know Hollywood is not an easy biz.
They were. And what Jeff also talked about is the amount of pedigree and fallbacks and privilege those other people had.
So, but yeah, I think the hard parts are the middle, especially when you're younger. You don't have anything under your belt, but so you can't look back and go, well, I got through this, therefore I can get through that. Right. But generally, I think the weaknesses that we have are also our strengths as black people, that you probably have gotten through something worse. By the time you're grown, you've probably gotten through something worse than whatever it is right now. You know, I was trying to talk to people about like different kind of I've never lived in poverty, but we've been at the low end of the middle class a lot in my childhood. So there's all kinds of foods that you'll talk about eating and people be like, oh yeah, we did that, you know, stuff like weird ass stuff. Struggle food, exactly. Right. And my wife would say poverty toys, like weird stuff that you would make a toy out of because you couldn't afford to do the thing. Right. And like, I don't know that a lot of the people who are in my competition and like these jobs have the same background, same kind of backgrounds. I look at most of them as fairly soft. Not in a bad way. They're very talented, a lot of them. But one of the things that people don't talk about in the entertainment industry is it's not an accident that you find out that a lot of these stars are either, let's forget the ones that are children of stars, because obviously, that's obvious, right? But a lot of them come from rich families, like whether they were connected or not. And when you have those lean times and you got a rich family where your fallback is going back to the mansion and chilling for a minute and regroup, you might feel bad, but it isn't bad. When me and my folks, the guys I came up with, when we fell off, it was like, what kind of job at 7-Eleven am I going to maybe get to cover, you know, to do this thing, you know, to stay in the game? Am I, can I stay in the game? And also, what kind of parts, when I quit, what kind of parts were being written for Black people? Or, I guess now, what kind of writing can a Black person really get to do? Like, I don't know, because I'm at a different stage in my career, what it is like starting out. But the idea of a Black guy writing a science fiction show that he made up, that didn't exist when I started. Like, that literally did not exist when I started. There's no such thing as that. Now, Jordan Peele's running a Twilight Zone.
Now, he'll have to decide what really matters to him when the laughter stops, and how much he's willing to give to the Twilight Zone.
That guy was a comedian. He was half of a comedy duo, right? Who knew he was a good writer and director, right? And on top of that, who knew he would choose the right subject matter at the right time to write and direct, right? All of these things had to happen, but they also had space for them to happen. And I feel like, I don't know that it's easier, but I think that the obstacles are slightly different now. There's more opportunity, so there's less obstacle. It's not that it's easier, but there's more opportunity.
Shout out to OBZ. Shout out to Jordan Peele and Issa Rae and Ava and Brandon Thomas and Easton and all the other Black folk killing it in the industry behind the scenes, giving us something to aspire to.
Word, word. But damn. Still got me thinking. Privilege is crazy. Because those folks weren't around or even prominent when Jeff got into the game. So it makes me wonder where Jeff found that strength in an unforgiving industry when his most viable option was feeling unfulfilled at a 7-Eleven.
Right. Especially in those early days when Jeff didn't have a body of work to fall in. But the cool thing about being Black is that we get to look at our past and gain strength in our stories and the deeds of our ancestors.
The hard part is everything in reality is set up against us in a lot of ways. A lot of being in the United States is Black people being told we're not wanted. You know this. After a certain age, you're not a cute little Black boy who's a little precocious. You're like, what you doing in this neighborhood, son? You know, were you following that lady too close, son? What are you doing in his store, mister? Things like that. That's just the light stuff. Getting called nigger by a teenager in a parking lot. Getting called nigger by some random dude walking up the street just cause. Like, you can't buy this apartment, but then your white girlfriend shows up, suddenly she can get the same apartment without you present. Like, just constant, right? But I always tell people, like, I'm 50s now, and this Afrocentrism stuff came around when I was in my 20s, the way it is right now, where people call themselves woke, called Afrocentric back then. And everybody was looking to Africa, like, we were kings in Africa, we were queens in Africa, my Nubian this, my Nubian that. And I was like, I don't need to look to Africa. I don't know who you think you're descended from, but everybody who didn't die in the Middle Passage, those are some hard-ass motherfuckers.
Because people died, just died. People jumped off their ships because they couldn't take it. People died of everything on the way over. And then other people died because they couldn't handle slavery. They couldn't take it. They killed themselves. They just couldn't take it. And every single one of those families produced everybody who's sitting here right now. I don't need any kings and queens. I'll take gladiators over that anytime. And they would look at me like I was crazy back then. And I was like, you got to understand that you don't know your history. In all of the history of the world, there's never been a group of people, no group of people, color is not part of it, who have been generationally enslaved and within 150 years are sitting on the boards of corporations, are running towns. And at this time, there was no Barack Obama, but throw that in, now running the country. That's it. If you're conservative and say it's 300 years since we've been on the surface of this country, 300 years we've been here, and look where we are now. All the stuff you guys, you young people, don't know about, all the inventions that you take for granted that came out of black brains. And then you think, this was invented in 1950. This was invented by a black woman in 1937. This thing you take for granted now. Think of the force of will that woman had to have, not just to be an inventor, not just to be female, but to be black in 1937 and get that patent. Come up with it and get that patent and then make it stick so she keeps earning the money off it for her family. You think about what was against us back then and all of those people, not even the big people, little people just trying to work every freaking day so their families don't starve. I don't need to see a freaking king to feel good about myself. I know where I come from.
So the wildest thing for me here is like, it makes me think about that Ta-Nehisi Coates statement where he was, or might not be a statement, in Between the World and We, I believe, when he was saying how he wasn't descended from kings, you know, like, or queens. Like, he would probably have been descended from the, you know, the servant of the king and the queen. And there is nothing to be ashamed of coming from, like, that ancestry. And it's kind of the same thing, like, you might have been descended from, say, a farmer, but that farmer had to go through, like, so much to keep that farm in those times, you know, in Jim Crow era. You know, you might have been descended from, say, you know, a caretaker, but that caretaker had to go through so much. So it's kind of like the struggle is not ugly, I guess, in retrospect. Or like there's beauty in the struggle, I guess I'm trying to say. And it's not to glorify it, it's just to more to like say, hey, this is what it was. This was a fact of life. These people triumphed and got through it, and they championed whatever dreams and goals as their descendants that we have. And it's commendable. It's just admirable to think about.
Yeah, I think we are progenies of slaves is how Ta-Nehisi Coates puts it. And
yeah,
the way Jeff is able to lean on that and be like, I'm struggling, but they was going through some real stuff is an outlook that I find powerful, because I think the way we perceive ourselves often is connected to the stories we tell about ourselves. And the way we look at our history isn't saying we came from power, but we have a history of overcoming struggle, which is very Green Lantern-y. You have the power to overcome great fear. We've got a whole history of speaking truth to that power by overcoming.
Yes.
And the ancestors had to be with him on his career path, because in the context of his blackness in that 7-Eleven and him quitting acting while they were cutting him checks seems wild.
Oh, no, that's real crazy. Because, I mean, okay, we kind of glossed over this, but to put some gravity on the situation, It was something like 10 years between his last steady acting work and that Star Trek story that he sold.
Right. There were like 5 or 6 acting gigs or something like that. But it was a struggle. Those times where he wasn't just worried about how his blackness affected his role in Hollywood, but also his ability to support his family and put food on the table.
You know, and also, by the way, as much as it's hard on us, just being black is a level of difficulty. Like, people don't want to talk about it like that. Like, you could say it the other way. Just being female is a level of difficulty in most professions. You have to account for it before you even do anything. Just being black is the same thing, right? Because the other guy didn't have to worry about that. And that's the difference between privilege and non-privilege. For instance, I'm 6'2". Right now I weigh over 300. But when I was in my prime, nobody was messing with me. Like, you had to be armed to step up to me. Not like I was putting that out, but you could tell from the vibe. People would be like, okay, he can come in here if he wants to. You know, like that. But if you're in a boardroom with somebody who's 5'1", and you're trying to get a job off them, the last thing you want to feel like is a threat. Right? What's he going to do if he ever gets mad? He's like King Kong, you know? Like, you have to think about it. But the same guy, same me, but white, doesn't have to think about that. Because they're not worried about him turning into an animal and destroying the building. Right? That's a level of difficulty. But that's just life to us. As soon as you start looking like a man nowadays, before you step out that door, you know it's on. So anything less than that is easy from my point of view. It's like playing a video game at like level 50 and then someone says, oh, we're going to bring out this brand new video game. But you've been playing it at 50 for like 2 years and they're all playing at level 1. You're going to look like a genius. So that's how I feel about it.
Okay. It's like you said at the beginning of the episode, right? We have to think about things that they don't like.
Yeah, and I'm sure that gap was hard in some ways we don't even understand. But Jeff built that shell, and he had an incredible ability to believe in himself. So let's fast forward in Jeff's life to where he's working in animation because he met McDuffie.
Yeah, that's also something else we type glossed over last time. Dwayne McDuffie was a giant in stature and in the comic book industry and in black comic book history.
Right. Justice League, Milestone, Static Shock. He's the OG.
So many black creators we know have their own McDuffie story. And his impact on them, way up there.
And that's the guy who flagged down Jeffrey Thorne in the middle of a Comic-Con and got him on Ben 10. Can't gloss over the OG. So thanks for giving us a moment to flesh that out.
Bet. All right, so now Jeff is in the game, right? He's in the race. So now what?
All of the black experience of the Thorne identity became Hollywood superpowers. Now, I don't exactly know when it is this last clip refers to, but I'd like to imagine Jeff kept that same energy when he was a showrunner.
Oh, you talking about Black Panther Quest, y'all. Check that out if you haven't as yet. So, Jeff told us about this when we talked to him the last time, our first interview with him. And we just had to sit on that info until the announcement, like, bro, crazy.
Good times, man. It was crazy sitting with insider information and being able to tell no one. But what's important is that man was running through sets with vibranium armor of his own.
You know, and so in those bad periods when you're sitting there in the dark, like, I'll tell you a story one time, not now because it's too long, but there was one time where I stayed up all night because everything was falling apart. And my wife came in. She's like, are you still sitting there? He had gone to bed, fallen asleep, woke up, and I was still sitting on the couch in the same position. And she's like, damn. And I was like, yeah, but I solved it. At about 4 o'clock in the morning, I solved this problem that had destroyed the day before. And I was like, I think this will work. And I tried it and it worked. But that 12-hour period, Thank God I don't drink, and thank God I didn't have a knife or a gun, because God knows what I would have done on the street that night. It was that bad of a day.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And, like, you can't, it's not like can't stop, won't stop, or everybody's going to get what they want, but you got to be in your corner. You got to be the cheerleader. You got to be the person that says, okay, stand up, because there's not always, there's almost never going to be somebody else to do it. Almost never. And if you assume that, then it doesn't pull you up short, right? But we just don't like your attitude. I'm like, well, you're not being paid to like my damn attitude. I don't know what attitude I'm supposed to have. I'm not mean. I'm not obnoxious. I just don't take shit from people. So if you don't give me any shit, we won't have a problem. Do we have a problem? Don't start none, won't be none. Are you not used to black people from the East Coast out here? Do you not have this kind of black person in San Francisco and Los Angeles? I bet you do. I guarantee you do, right? So it was like that. It was a very hostile environment. And then I got into LA, which is all hostile, but I'd already sort of built up a shell. The kind of crap that gets thrown at you in Hollywood, I'm like, people used to, I remember one producer, I was on a show and we were doing some of the stuff you do when you're a producer is like, what's the word? You're just going over the day's work, and like, there's always problems. Some actor did this, or you can't get a set, or a generator blew up and you need a new one, just stuff. Every day, and you go through it like a checklist, and there's always people beefing at each other, and there's always problems. And a lot of people get mad and freak out and get mad. They get you mad at somebody else. A third person will get mad because you're mad at somebody else. And I'll sit there just like eating my food, taking my notes. And at the end of it, one of the producers, the other producer, was like, what is up with you? And I was like, what's with the bass in your voice? What did I do? Like, what's going on? Right. And he's like, do you care about any of this stuff? And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking. I was like, I'm drawing a blank, man. I don't know what you're talking about here. We just did a great day. We finished a little early. I'm eating my sushi. What's up? Right. And he's like, well, we did all this stuff and you just didn't blink. You smiled. You were white all day, whatever. And I would say these are assets in a producer, because I was a new producer, right? I was like, you want me to get excited? You want me to freak out? Like, what was I meant to be doing that I'm not doing right now? He's like, it just didn't seem like you cared. And I just leaned in on the guy and I was like, did anybody die? Was anybody going to die? Did any of those problems amount to a punch in the face or a loss of a lot of money or any of that? And they're like, but Jeff. And I was like, don't but. You asked me, I'm going to tell you. I've been on shows where somebody died. You know what happens when somebody dies on a TV show? You might lose a day. Everybody freaks out. They freak out. And then they go, okay, this is a multi-million-dollar operation. We better get the wheels rolling again. So somebody else got to step into that role. You writers need to rewrite to accommodate whoever we cast tonight to step into the role of the person who just died. Sorry about it, family of the person who just died, but we got to make this show. So, and that's when somebody died. I've been on shows where the cops raided people and took them off to jail for other offenses that had nothing to do with the show. And I'm like, and you know what happened? The show kept rolling. Like, sometimes they didn't even stop rolling. That person just got taken away, and we found out after what had happened, right? So why am I supposed to get so upset about this little beef between these two idiots across the table, right? They want to fight with each other. All I would tell them to do is, if you really feel like that, take it outside, but don't waste my time in my little boardroom, because we're trying to make a show. And they were just like, huh? I was like, yeah. So there's just nothing that's going to make me angry. There's nothing that can happen in these rooms that can make me angry. Real life can make me angry, but that's not real. So when you say these rough patches, they were rough. You listen to those stories. I went through them. They were actually rough. So if you can get through that, this little light shit, eh, you know?
That's really the same energy we get from Jeff when we talk to him. Always professional, but that decorum comes with a level of ease, you know, just straight up coolness about him.
It's one of those things I love about him, and I really enjoy having him on the show.
Right, right. So, cool if we take a break before we keep it going?
Yeah, it seems like a good time, because when we get back, we're going to talk about how Jeff's blackness affects his work. Sup, y'all? It's Lou here with the second reason to pick up Green Lantern number one, and that's the artwork. This art team didn't come to play, and Owa looks better than I've ever seen it in my years of reading Green Lantern comic books. Having several planets from across the galaxy on Owa makes the Conclave a perfect place to flex your artistic abilities. Different species, a bit of action, a bit of diplomacy, and a whole lot of colors make this book worth picking up. That's Green Lantern number one with Jeffrey Thorne, Dexter Soy, Marco Santucci, Alex Sinclair, and Rob Lay. Now back to our conversation with Jeff. So, there's something I want to hit on, and that's the particular approach Jeff takes to blackness in his writing.
Okay, what's that?
He's not like Priest, who didn't want to be the black character guy, or David Walker, who works makes you stare down systemic issues in society. He falls somewhere in between.
I won't say that I once read an article with Christopher Priest was talking about comics in general. He came up the hard way. He was an editor and an assistant, did all this other stuff backstage before he got to write one word of a comic book. Same with Dwayne McDuffie, by the way. They both sort of came in the hard way, right? But he's like, look, I know I did okay on the Black Panther and everything. Please don't keep throwing these black characters at me. You know, like, I don't want to be that dude, right? We're like, oh, somebody needs to do Luke Cage. There's Chris Priest. He's black. You know, he didn't want that. He wanted to have a real career, and he's right. You know, he wanted to be able to do anything, not just the black folks. Me, I'm the other way. I have another career. I work in TV. I work in novels, mostly TV, animation. So I don't have as much control over the product there as I would like. Obviously, I'm working on other people's shows. They're not my show. And I do my best for them because that's my job. But if someone says, hey, at Marvel or DC, what would you like to do? It's not going to be Superman. It's going to be Bronze Tiger. It's going to be Black Panther or Night Thrasher or Vixen or Storm or M or one of the characters that doesn't get spotlight for whatever reason. You know, and then not that I would not tell a story about Nightwing, who I love, or Oracle, who I love. But there's a million people trying to do that. There's like four people trying to tell a story about Vixen. So, and they usually don't get a shot at it, right? So I'm the mirror of Chris Priest in that I'm like, yeah, throw me any black character you think you can't make work. I'll make it work. Okay? So that's how my blackness informs which jobs I do for the big two.
Ooh, that sort of reminds me of Octavia Butler in the Throughline episode that you and I were talking about, where she was talking about, yeah, where she was talking about her blackness and her womanness, where those things were already a part of her. And while it wasn't, she didn't want to use it as a crutch. She didn't want to lean on it. But since they were there and they were entirely her, they had to come out of her writing. They had to be in her pieces, you know. Without them, she wouldn't be who she was, and the stories wouldn't be what they were. So it wasn't even a second or third thought. It was just there.
Right. It's that whole auteurist angle where we don't think here on the Poyev podcast that you could tell a good story without inserting yourself in it. And Jeff is keenly aware of it. Jeff's a fan of Octavia Butler's writing, so influence of the science fiction OG, the speculative fiction OG is probably in there too. And it's an approach that at a glance might seem like he's backing away from his blackness, but that's not it at all. And if you've ever read a Jeffrey Thorne comic book, you know that man is blackity black.
Yeah, so essentially, he just wanted to write what he knows. And I mean, beyond knowing celebrity, like he talked about in Mosaic, he also knows black people that don't fit that quote-unquote typical mold.
right? And though Mosaic was a black athlete for all of half of one issue, and that may be present in other mediums, he brought so much more richness to that comic book. We know people who are hard on Mosaic, and we didn't talk about it in the original cut, but they didn't even make it to those 12 issues they planned for. They just got 9.
Yeah, and this is where representation gets a little complex, because we had homies who were hypercritical of this idea of a black Hooper with a LeVar Ball type dad and an Iggy Azalea type girlfriend.
Yeah, people will buy a subpar Batman run and it'll do numbers because dude has had 8 decades of clout. And books like Mosaic don't get the time to find an audience because people are hypercritical. When I say people in this case, I mean black people.
Yo, Batman really just be out here on mediocrity. Man, but yo, it's like N.K. Jemisin says, you'll feel like you're in a good place when black people can succeed while being average, because we have to be excellent to get in the door, and then sometimes that's not even enough.
And to be clear, we don't think Mosaic was an average book. However, a black book with Big 2 distribution and actual ad posters got bogged down by line-wide events and a lack of time.
And lack of readership. Bottom line is, we gotta buy our books, yo.
Here's the thing: the quiet story about black comics or gay comics or Latin comics, whatever. When they're in the mainstream, a lot of people do a lot of woofing about what they want to see, but when they come out, they don't buy them. Let me put it like this: let me say, what if I'd made Mosaic white? Everything the same, except he's white. He's a golfer. But the thing is, if that book had come out and done it all well, all the questions that you would be asking is, how come you came up with a white character? They gave you a chance to come up with anything and you came up with a white character.
God.
Right? That's what everyone would say. Okay. So I'm like, well, if this is my shot, and I also don't want to be that guy who comes up with a character that's like, we can do everything. Right? He's everything man. He's black and he's everything. Black everything man. And I was like, no. So I tried to come up with a character that we would all be able to grip into. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the numbers fell off. We fell below, I think we had, for that book, we needed to do, I think, 15K or more a month. We got down to 6.5.
Ooh.
So they could have kept us if they had big plans for it. Like, they'll float a book a little longer if they're like, and this could be a TV show, or this could be a movie, let's float it at least out to 12. Right? But, weren't enough people. There's just not enough people bought it, and you got to move on.
And okay, so Jeff has been in and out of the comics game since Mosaic, right? But every time he's on a project, he's leaving a mark.
Until really recently, in the movie industry and the TV industry, black people occupy the same space in these kind of fiction, which is largely to make the white hero look better, right? I can beat up a Klingon. Strangely, all the Klingons are black and Latin, but I beat up a bunch of them. Damn, he must be a hell of a fighter. He beat up all those Klingons. You never really see the Klingons just kicking everybody's ass, though, right? You never see, like, the aftermath of a Klingon beatdown. You never come into a room and go, oh, a 13-year-old Klingon just beat up this battalion of hardened troopers, right? You never see that. You see the one tough white dude beat up all these brown Klingons, right? And it's fine, because we're all used to that. But, or the doorman, right? The tough, edgy, white cop shows up. Big black guy at the door is like, look, you're not on the list, man. You can't get in. Like, I'm going in there. It's like, yeah, you're going in there through me. I'm 6'8". I can lift your car. Right? Yeah. And then you watch the white guy chop the dude down and walk into that bar like he said he was going to. Right? So you're really set up as the obstacle for the white guy to look there. Right? Or you're that black captain. Damn it, Riggs. You can't go out there. Those people will kill you. It's suicide. You're going to get those hostages killed. But it's the only way, Captain. Right? And the captain's like, damn it, if you do this, I want your badge and your gun. Fine. Badge, gun. And then he goes and does it anyway. And then at the end, what happens? The captain's like, well, here's your badge and your gun back, you son of a bitch. You were right.
It's lethal weapon, all the lethal weapons.
Right? So I'm like, I'm not participating in that fiasco. I feel like I don't have to lean all the way the other way. All I have to do is play it straight down the middle, and everybody comes out looking great. So right now, what have I done? I created Mosaic for Marvel, a black character. I also wrote Solo, but what? Since nobody read Solo, because you're all fools, you should have read Solo. Jerry Duggan had created a baby mama for that character who you never saw. He just mentioned her from time to time. And I said, hey, can she be Afro-Latina? And he's like, sure. So we made up a whole backstory about Solo's ex, Katita. She's the one you should be making a book about. She was like, if the Black Widow and her ran into each other in a bar, be like, oh, what's up, Kat? What's up, Nat? Like that. And she just quit. She quit being a spy. But unlike all the other spies in Marvel or DC, she actually quit, had a baby, and she's just chilling with her baby, right? Because she stacked up her chips. It's like, I'm not getting scarred in my face because I'm hot, and I'm going to go live someplace tropical with this little baby of ours and spend this giant amount of money that I made being a killer or whatever I was doing, a mercenary. And when your ass grows up, maybe you'll join us, she says to her ex-man, right? Solo. But the fun thing in the book was whenever he got in too deep, which was always, he would call her, hey, Kat, so hypothetically, if you were at the bottom of a Hydra base and a whole bunch of mandroids were at the other end of the hall and you had the one exit and it was on the other side of the mandroids, and she'd cut him off. She's like, James, are you at the bottom of a Hydra base with a whole bunch of mandroids between you and the exit? It's like, yes, you took that one job that I told you not to take, didn't you? I don't have to answer that. Yeah, you took that job. All right, look, first thing you need to know, mandroid armor does this, 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 and this, right? So all you have to do is move left really fast, run down the center, and then they'll all be facing each other and their systems will lock up. You'll have 3 seconds to get into that elevator and get the hell out of Dodge. I suggest you move and hang up. Like, don't call me again with this nonsense. Click. That was Katita. Now, we did not have to make her anything. We never need to show her face. But same thing when I took over Knight Rider for Lionforge. Michael Knight. Obviously, everybody knows Knight Rider. But I invented Tabitha Bishop, a black woman who was the Black Widow, basically, to his Captain America or whatever. And she was hard as hell, too. Jumps from one SUV to another, kills everybody in the first car, jumps to another car, crashes that car. She's just bad as hell. So when you go through the catalog, what you'll see is stuff like that, right? If there's no reason not to do it, do it, is the way I look at it. And do it in such a way that it is not me on a soapbox going, black people matter. You know, black lives matter. I don't have to do that because I already know that. I'm black. Of course, the black lives matter. But if I just fold everybody in, they have to matter, especially if I make them cool. Not cooler than not cooler than Captain America, right? If the book's called Captain America, he's the coolest person in the book. But cool enough that you go, oh, damn, she could roll with Captain America. She might need her own book.
And it seems to be paying off because Jeff started 2021 with a Black Panther story, a Vixen story, and a Green Lantern story starring Jon Stewart, all within the same month.
How in the world did you finesse having an issue with T'Challa, Jon Stewart, and Vixen all come out within 30 days of each other?
I don't know. I wish I had a formula. I don't know. People just kept saying, would you like to? And I kept saying yes. I mean, like, I tried so hard to get on the Black Panther book, you guys don't even know. And I thought that ship had sailed. Will Moss emailed me and he's like, look, we're about to have a one-shot open up in this King in Black thing for the Black Panther. You want it? And I was like, can I say no? Can anyone ever say no to that? Yeah, I got to say yes. So I said yes. Chris Cross is the one who got the Vixen book going. I didn't start that. He just decided he wanted to do it, and he wanted me to be on it, and everybody was cool with it, so we did it. But that's all on Chris. I was just like, I had a neat notion about how Vixen should work. And he's like, I like it. I'm telling my editors, we're doing this. And I was like, what are you talking about? So, yeah, I just signed up for nothing. But he was right, because at the end of it, I'm like, I'm down to do a whole book. Like, we were going to do a one shot. I was like, I never even thought about doing a Vixen book. I mean, I had a neat idea about how Vixen's power should work. I'm ready to like roll with Vixen now. Like, I'm ride or die for that shit. Like, I'm ready for that. But again, that could just as easily have been Huntress. It could have been Batgirl. I had some great ideas for Batgirl, but I'm not putting myself in the front of the line for those characters. There's a billion people trying to write those characters, right? Nobody's trying to write these other ones. Nobody's trying to write Vixen.
So that's why Jeff is the right person to take on Jon Stewart at the head of the Green Lantern title, because he saw himself in sci-fi, because he's worked his ass off to be a writer in this industry, and because he, like Jon Stewart, is a black man, and they have a shared existence that he could speak to.
I like how you brought that all the way back around. Dope.
Yeah. Next time, we get into Jeff's Green Lantern run and all the crazy things that are going to happen.
And it's rough, because if your ass is in deep space, when your ring goes away, you are a dead Green Lantern. Nobody is safe. Even John is not safe. Nobody is safe. Well, three of them are safe. So all of these are clues to how I'm thinking about the book, is what I'm leading up to. I'm not saying this is all so great. I'm saying you've had a limited view, and DC Comics basically said you don't have to have that limited view anymore. You can now expand out. You can do stuff that connects to the Legion. I use New Gods in this thing. It's not that it's never been done before, but I'm just saying everything's on the plate.
Oh, just a madman, yo. Crazy.
All right. So that's all we have for the Jeff Part 1 remixed. This is the real version, so we get the close. You can follow us on Twitter at PoYiffPod. We have an IG, same thing. Don't use it much. We also have our own personal Twitter accounts. You can find me at ShensDeGrio. _ under Shens and Duh.
You can catch me at Word to Wilson. So it's Word, the number 2, and then Wilson. I'll be dropping, I guess like reviews of books, comics, movies that I like. That's really all I'll be doing.
Jeff be on Twitter too. Normally I guess say it, but we were so into this conversation I forgot to ask. So you can find him at Jeff Thorne. That's GeoffThrone. And go pick up Green Lantern number 1, available in stores now.
Get that joint.
All right. And we're going to close this episode with another one of our core podcast questions.
That's right. We asked Jeff the power he got from seeing himself in fiction. And after hearing his story, dog, that thing hits different, yo. Hits different.
There's a power that you acquire once you realize you have that person that resembles you in fiction. Mm-hmm. In a single thought, what would be that power that you would say you got once you saw those characters in Star Trek, and then once you saw those characters in the sci-fi novels that you read?
Everything is out there for me to get. I'm in the world. Everything's out. I'm in the race. I'm not watching the race. I'm in it. I can be in it. Nobody can keep me out.
Sweet. I love it.
Might be hard, but nobody said it wasn't going to be hard. I'm in it. You can't keep me out.
Yeah. That's real.